Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's reconvene, if you will. This is the third session, and we're dealing with Germany and Russia in our third panel. I think Fyodor, I'm Will Hitchcock. Since you're just joining us, we might very quickly go around our table here just to introduce ourselves. I teach here at UVA in the history department, and I'm one of the three organizers of this event. It's great to have you with us. I'm glad you could make it virtually, if not in person.
Yes, and I'm Mel Leffler. I'm also part of the Miller Center here at University of Virginia, and I teach on the history faculty.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Eli Levite. I'm with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I'm an Israeli.
Hi, Jim Steinberg, Maxwell School of Syracuse University.
Mark Selberstone, historian at the Miller Center, working on the tapes of Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon.
Yuri Urbanovich, I teach in the Department of Politics and in the Department of Slavic Languages as well, but I am a former professor at the Diplomatic Academy of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Oh. I know this academy very well.
Fyodor Constanzi, you know me. Too bad you aren't here.
I'm Kimberly Martin, Barnard College at Columbia.
And I'm Jeff LeGros, University of Virginia, political science.
I'm Yaprak Gürsoy from Istanbul Bilgi University.
So how about over here? Why don't you guys just sit here?
I'm Ben Brady. I'm a graduate student in the history department.
Evan McCormick, also a history graduate student.
I'm Chris Monahan, from the Ed School of the International Education.
Mike Poznanski, a politics graduate student.
Sam Pfeiffer, politics graduate.
Hi, Kate Sanger, okay. Politics PhD.
All right, well, without further ado, we'll get underway. Our first panelist is Constanze Stelzenmüller, who's going to give us a summary of her paper. She's a senior transatlantic fellow with the German Marshall Fund and also has a long experience working in journalism as an editor at Die Zeit. And it's just great to have you here. Why don't you take 8 or 10 minutes, as the other panelists have done? You can feel free to summarize your paper, or as Ellie very boldly did, offer a second paper.
I have to say that I was shaken into action first by Phil Zelikow's comments on the first three papers, and then and additionally motivated by Ellie. So yes, I decided to reorganize myself. I'm assuming that everybody's read all the papers, and I'm more than willing to take sort of detailed line-by-line criticism on those, but I think that what we're trying to do here is something else, so I've regrouped. Thank you, above all, for inviting me here. This has reminded me of my wonderful 3 years at graduate school in America. I was at Harvard for 3 years, the Kennedy School, and at the law school, and it was an exhilarating experience. And so is this. In fact, I was thinking that actually, you know, this is really, it's only too bad we're only doing this for 1.5 days. The German Marshall Fund has a thing called the Transatlantic Academy, where we sort of, you know, do a sort of year-by-year think tank thing where we pull people together. And I was just thinking, frankly, how much fun it would be, you know, if we could go on doing this for about 9 months. That would be... I'd love it. Oh, all right, come on.
No, I'm just trying to say they're trying to think of now what the implications for them are.
Well, we can exchange jokes, for example, about each other's countries. But to be serious, the other thing, of course, and you've just said that, Mr. Hitchcock, that I'm sort of in many ways sort of the odd woman out here, because I don't really have a strategy background. I was trained as an international lawyer and then was a journalist for 13 years for a local paper in Berlin and then at Die Zeit, where I did sort of crisis zone reporting and started off in Somalia and Rwanda and worked my way inwards and ended up as defense and security editor. So in many ways, I mean, I have practical experience and a sort of also academic framing that is useful for these discussions, but some other aspects that you're all very familiar with are new to me, including the sort of language of how to articulate these issues. So, and there are also, and I realized this while writing my paper, there are just things I don't know enough about, like energy policy, for example, where I need to know much more to pronounce with any confidence. That said, I will also say that just the exercise of having to write this paper has had a sort of fairly remarkable impact on me, in that I've, for the first time in my life, come to the conclusion that I actually might have a book to write. So thank you for that already. That's fairly significant, actually.
We asked for just a footnote at the beginning. The idea first arrived.
I'm very happy to do that, actually. No, absolutely. The other thing I've got five comments I want to make. The first bunch are really sort of meta-level comments that sort of came to me as I was listening to all the other presentations and the commentary. And that is that, of course, this tension between current affairs and grand strategy is unresolvable, I think. It's been criticized, but, you know, I think that is what we live with and is what we do. And when you have cultures such as that of my country, where strategic ambiguity is a matter of choice, if you will, and indeed, I think, a profound personal choice and a leadership style, as far as the Chancellor is concerned, you have to extrapolate grand strategy from the handling of policy and from maybe even offhand remarks, yeah. And that is just the way it is. Yeah. That doesn't mean there isn't a grand strategy, and I'm personally inclined to think there is, but much of it, of course, and I'll come to that in a moment, is a little different than say the grand strategy of a superpower would look like, yeah, because the constraints are just different. And I think that is, if Phil Zelikow were sitting here, that's the point that I would make. I mean, his framing is in many ways a uniquely American one. And his critique is an American one. I think it misses some of the sort of operating environmental difficulties that an emerging power of the size of Germany or Turkey encounter. Second meta point is, and that leads directly to that, the tensions between the operational and the strategic. German governments in general, and I think this German government and this chancellery are known for being highly operational and quite effective when they're being operational. Case in point being Germany's Moldova policy, right? Where the chancellor Merkel is the first chancellor to have gone to Moldova. Yeah? This has been handled personally by the National Security Advisor, Hoyske. Yeah? And so, in some ways, you could say that I think you could, in fact, make a convincing argument that this sort of operational policy is rooted in strategic thinking. But what is visible to you, to us, is going to be the operational part. Which is not to say that there aren't, you know, then incoherences that you can discuss and critique. Then there is another tension that I think came out in today's discussions between the sort of very understandable, legitimate search by academics and writers for drama and narrative. Okay. And certainly events in Ukraine these days are providing a sense of drama, and any culture that's as profoundly narcissistic and dramatically inclined as mine is, you know, likes to have that. I mean, it's very helpful in framing things. But at the same time, if we want to be sort of intellectually rigorous about this, we have to be very careful in resisting the temptation to over-dramatize and to overemphasize a narrative where there isn't one. And to make sure that we also look very attentively at the incoherences, the inconsistencies, the lack of articulation, and in fact the lack of articulation, not of something that is actually there, but where there is no there, because nobody's thought about it. Yeah. Such as the Germany-Turkey relationship that we were talking about earlier. So then I come to my three main points. And the first one is about the strategic, and I'm addressing, I think, your larger goals in this conference and what you were saying, Priscilla Leffler, earlier. The strategic operating environment for all of us, I think, has become very, very similar. What we're looking at and what is of interest to all of us is what is its specific impact on emerging powers. Yeah? And I think all of the emerging powers, and it's sort of, I'm still grinning at thinking of Germany as an emerging power, but so be it. All of us are finding ourselves in a situation where we are less powerful than we thought we might be, increasingly less powerful. In other words, you were saying this earlier, that there's sort of a declining sense of power for many of us. And that, of course, is a function of interdependence. You know? At the same time, though, we are finding ourselves faced with huge expectations from our partners, our allies, from the people who maybe feel threatened by us, and from our own domestic publics. So in those conditions, I think at least for the emerging powers, but I think to some degree, even for a superpower like the US, the true meaning of power has been not so much shaping, making others do what you want them to do, yeah, or shaping your environment successfully, permanently, sustainably, but solving problems. Yeah, the ability to solve problems in such a way that you get others to agree with you and to partner with you. Yeah. And I think that this element of solving problems in a common interest and together with others is so key, because interdependence means that there are almost no problems that affect us only as a single nation, or whose solution we don't need to negotiate with somebody else, partners or even neighbors or even much farther away partners. And the other aspect, I think, key aspect of power that's under-examined is that it's the ability to manage change. So that's something, both of these, solving problems and managing change, are less ambitious than shaping your environment or making other people do what you want them to do. But they are, in an environment of interdependence, actually already pretty ambitious, and I think we can see all of our countries trying and failing to achieve that. And I think that's an important way to frame the situation we find ourselves in. What it also means is... sorry, is that a question?
I think it was just
so was managing change and?
Managing change and solving problems. That's
you're just getting a...
Oh, I'm getting an echo. All right, that's great. right. Germans like having an echo, but this is confusing. Where was I? So the in all this, the ability to manage expectations and perceptions of the power assets and resources that we have becomes increasingly important in our ability to solve problems, to manage change, and to leverage these assets. But again, I insist on the point that our ability to shape things the way we would like them is really quite limited. And in fact, I think, and the Libya operation was I think exhibit A in this. We are quite limited in our ability to understand events that are shaping us. And one of the key issues for many of us is our limited ability to analyze, to understand, and to form sort of valid judgments on which to base policy about our strategic operating environments. That's, I think, increasingly a problem. That is not to say, of course, and there's a sort of fallacy based on this assessment in many countries, including mine, that means grand strategy is impossible and or unnecessary. I think that's untrue. I think the reverse is true. I think it puts a premium on our ability to formulate grand strategy, if only because it is part of the intellectual process that is necessary to understand your operating environment and how it shifts, and how you can develop realistic priorities and match your ends and means to your goals. Now, my second point here is, what's the German specificity in all this? Obviously, we're special in so many ways. It's something we share with the Americans and with the Israelis, but we are especially challenged by the way by the fact that we have a history of being hyper-determined and hyper-constrained in the ways that we were able to articulate strategies and goals for much of our post-war history. And the 25 years nearly that have passed since the regaining of full sovereignty, the ending of the occupation statute, etc., have shown that our general default reflex is to be highly incremental, cautious, to pretend that all those corset rigs are still there, and that we're really that whatever choices we make really come from an external constraint, whether it's a normative one, a factual one, or one that where we say this is because such and such are our values or our interests, we are forced to make this choice. So there's, if you will, the German sort of strategy history after 1990 has been a denial of agency, in a way that to our allies and friends has been startling, disturbing, confusing, and often just has seemed completely hypocritical. But if you were sitting in Bonn or then Berlin, in many ways it has seemed that way. And the irony and the paradox, of course, of our current development is that the strategic and operating environment that we find ourselves in, of course, is reducing our powers of agency. So we're recovering full agency and a sense of agency at a time when that is becoming increasingly constrained. That's slightly difficult to get your mind around, much less get your policy around. Let me see. Where was
I? I'm eyeballing the clock.
I'm nearly done. Last point. The Yeah. The sort of a last sentence on the German specificity, and of course all of the we thought, I think, for a moment about half a year ago, or maybe even still in Munich when Gauck gave that famous speech, that we had arrived at a moment where we were out of the European crisis and in a moment of sort of hiatus where we could start actually doing that kind of framing, yeah, and maybe start defining a grand strategy. And all of that's been upended by the Ukraine crisis, which has reorganized our constraints and our priorities in ways that I think are only beginning to be examined, and that I sort of make some remarks about at the end of my paper. But my final point is about what does all that mean about our understanding of the global environment? In other words, how do we loop that back to what is the actual topic of your of the conference and of the book that you want to publish? And I think what it means is that the paradigm of interdependence is one that has created enormous opportunities for us of growth, of mutual sort of greater comprehension of interaction with each other, of engagement with each other, of overcoming sort of old boundaries and enmities. But at the same time, it carries enormous risks because we have all become accustomed in the last quarter century to a sort of, because we found ourselves unable for all sorts of reasons to reformalize or to adapt the international order to be more inclusive and to be more inclusive and more effective in the ways that, for example, the Brazilians would like. And therefore, we've become accustomed to ad hocery, informalism, and crisis management and problem solving as a sort of as a default mode of operating. And the result of that is, I think, is that the risk of misunderstood messaging, of frictions escalating into bad stuff happening, is enormous. And I think at this point, uncontrollable. And it means that we, I think, at our peril, continue in this sort of attitude of not paying attention to the imperative of adapting an international order and reformalizing the way we do business among each other. I think one way of a useful conceptual way of thinking about this operating paradigm is that of a global ecosystem. Yeah. I think interdependence has reached a stage, and we've seen that in the economic crisis, and particularly in the transatlantic conflict on the impact of the economic crisis on each other's economies, yeah, and which of course then is resulted in the TTIP negotiations, that we already have such an ecosystem, and that it has a profound impact on the way we frame other issues, including security issues. Now, is that overwhelming? Yes, it is. Is it incredibly hard to figure out ways of doing that? Yes. But I think the alternative is one, and that brings me to Ari's point. The alternative is one where we're looking at a world of gated communities and warring kingdoms and sort of a universal virtual relocation. And that's not a world I'd like to live in. Thank you.
Thank you, Constanza. That's very thoughtful. And goes well beyond what you wrote, so we have a lot of material to discuss when we come back to you. Fyodor, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
Good. So you're up. I'd like to ask you to summarize your paper in 8 or 10 minutes. Give us, or indeed go beyond the paper itself if you like, if you are so moved. All of you can read the biography in our program. Fyodor Lukyanov is editor-in-chief of Russia and Global Affairs and has an experienced journalist and political analyst. And it's interesting that our Germany and Russia panel is dominated by people who have a long experience in the media. So maybe that's something we can bring out in the conversation. Fyodor.
Thank you very much for... First of all, for invitation, and of course, since it was that unfortunate, so then thank you for this opportunity to speak and to participate in this session. I was not the most disciplined member of the group, and I apologize for that. So I didn't send anything in time, but hopefully the next stage will be more successful on my side. Of course, to to write about Russian strategy just now, and I started to write well in advance, but then in the last 4 or 5 weeks I had to not to change everything, but to revise my thoughts profoundly, because we are really entering a completely new stage here in Russia, and that would be very very arrogant on my side to say that I know what Russian strategy is. But certainly something is happening which will shape next period, and the logic of behavior seems to be in months or maybe even years to come different than we used to believe in previous years. First of all, I will limit myself to several points, partly based on my paper, partly go beyond that. First of all, the difference, the specificity of Russia in the context we discuss at our conference is that Russia is not an emerging power, but a re-emerging power. Of course, we emphasized that even before, but now these days it's especially important, because we see that a lot of steps and a lot of acts undertaken here in Moscow are defined by the willingness and desire really to re-emerge, and this is a very important leitmotif of everything which happens now. 3-4 weeks ago, I would say that the transition period after the collapse of the Soviet Union has been completed, and of course, with all differences between three Russian presidents, okay, let's count Medvedev as a president as well. So with all differences among them, the idea of Yeltsin, Putin, Medvedev, say Putin 1 and 2 and Medvedev, was basically the same: to re-establish Russia as a big power, as an important part of international relations, as an actor who sits at the table where decisions will be made. And, of course, means were pretty different. Capacities were very much different. If we compare Russia 1995 with Russia, for example, 2005, it's two very much different countries. But the main goal was to show that Russia is able to recover, and Russia is still part of the most important club, the club of countries which really decide what is happening. This task has been more or less completed by the end of 2000s. The important event was war with Georgia, of course, which was not so much about Georgia, but mainly about NATO expansion and attempt to draw a red line and to state that Russian strategic geopolitical retreat is over, and now it's time to start a new era. And after this task has been fulfilled, approximately it coincided with Putin's comeback to power 2 years ago. It seemed that we really needed a completely new agenda which would replace this idea about restoration, because we Russia restored everything it could do, actually, by means of economic development, political recovery, military recovery, and so on. And at the same time, the issue of identity came up quite high on the agenda, because the old identity, which we basically inherited from the Soviet time, and which remained with us 20 years after collapse of the Soviet Union, the identity showed to be much more stable and resistant than anybody could believe. But anyway, by the end of 2000s, this identity has been exhausted. And despite the fact that collapse of the Soviet Union recently served as a starting point for many discussions and debates. A couple of years ago, many people got, including those in Kremlin, got a feeling that those debates about Soviet Union, collapse of the Soviet Union, about what came after, those debates are absolutely fruitless. So they don't generate anything new, only repetition of the same. And that's why Putin, when he came back, was faced a dilemma, what to do next, to try to continue this this framework, the post-Soviet framework, basically, to try to restore more, to try to get more out of what was lost 1991, or to make a next step and to try to establish a new identity, which would not be that dependent on Soviet time, on Soviet past, and which would ideally include Russian history in more in longer retrospective. And until quite recently, many analysts here and people here had a feeling that Putin decided for this more promising, more future-oriented notion to try to create a new identity. And even the strange discourse, strange narrative we got last year about the conservative values, and this narrative produced several pretty ugly law legislations and implications. But it seemed to be rather break up with the Soviet and post-Soviet tradition and attempt to reconnect to Russia, which was before the Soviet Union. Now it seems that Russia and Putin turned towards another option, which is to try to get more out of collapse of the Soviet Union and so to say, to replay the final stage of the Cold War, to try to prove that a Russian or Soviet defeat at that time was an accident. It wasn't a logical consequence of this confrontation. It was something which happened with Russian leadership. Anyway, it seems that the Soviet Union breakup is again a central notion of the whole strategy. Whether it is a strategy or not, there are a lot of debates just now. Some analysts believe, based on what happened recently with Crimea and Ukraine, they believe that Putin and his team, he had something like a grand design since several years. And this grand design was to restore something, maybe not necessarily Soviet Union, but a sphere of influence which maybe is more based on an ethnic Russian tradition and Russian cultural tradition rather than the Soviet Union as an empire. So that's a big the discussion. What is behind the contemporary logic? Is it imperial or, in fact, anti-imperial, ethnically colored? But anyway, some other people, me included, believe that it wasn't a grand design. It was just a reaction to coincidence of circumstances which allowed to do what has been done recently. Anyway, another important point is that there is a discussion in Western media and even here in Russia as well, whether Russia today is a revisionist power or not revisionist power. So looking from the outside, looking from America, from Europe, Russia is dangerously revisionist. Looking from here, and I think that it's something like a consensus in Kremlin and strategic community connected to Kremlin and Moscow, that Russia is not revisionist, because in order to be revisionist, you need to have a stable world order which you challenge. And this is a deep belief here, that stable world order did not emerge after the end of the Cold War. And what we have now is just a transitory state, and it will change anyway. It's just a situational constellation of forces, powers, and that will change. So Russia is not about to revise the order which emerged, rather than Russia is part of the game, part of the process. And the aim is to create better conditions to raise stakes for the next period when this new order will start to emerge. And that will be not defined by US or Europe. That will be defined by many powers, including Asian and others. Important point which I mentioned in my paper, and it certainly be one of most important leitmotifs in years to come, there is a Russian shift to Asia. Of course, it started well in advance. It started much before recent crisis around Ukraine erupted. And a couple of months ago, in December to last year, in his address to Federal Assembly, Putin stated very, very boldly that Siberia, Far East, and Asia is Russian priority for the whole 21st century. And this is, of course, a very big change, because it should manifest different lenses through which Russia is trying to look at international affairs and at Russian place in international setup. Because traditionally, since very, very long time, since several centuries, Russia was very much Western-centric. Not necessarily pro or anti-Western, but Western-centric. So all developments were judged by how it will influence Russian relationship with the West. It seems that now this optics will start to change, and that it has nothing to do with the particular relationship with the West and with Europe or United States. It's a growing understanding in Russia, and this is very widespread belief, that in the 21st century, when Asia is certainly a strategic arena number one, the most important centerpiece of international development, it's not affordable for Russia anymore to be as Western-centric as before. How Russia will manage to combine the traditional cultural, historic, and humanitarian ties to Europe, because Russia remains a European power, whatever Russian leadership wants, how to combine this with a completely different geopolitical and, most importantly, geoeconomic orientation, it remains to be seen. It's an open question. But it's certainly the most problematic dilemma for Russian leadership, regardless what will happen in Ukraine, around Ukraine, and in our relationship with the European Union. And finally, but last but not least, I think it's very important characteristics of Russia. Russian strategic approach differs Russia very much from all other countries we discussed at our conference. Economics is not the most important thing for Russian leadership. It's very much politically motivated and politically driven actions, and they assume that political gains will after that anyway be transformed into economic gains. But not economy is priority. Priority is a political presence, political influence, and that means that many moves which are seen in the West through the lenses of economically viable or not economically viable, this criteria is not necessarily the first one, or certainly not the first one, which Russian leadership applies when it tries to formulate a strategy.
Thank you, Fyodor. Thank you. That's very helpful. Getting a little reverb. I'd like to turn to Kim Martin now for some comment and thoughts about these two papers and about some of the big questions that have been put on the table. Just so everybody knows, you can see her biography, but she's the Olin Professor of Political Science at Barnard and helps to lead Columbia's Harriman Institute. Kim.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I very much enjoyed reading both of these papers. What I'm going to do is talk about four common themes that I see in the papers, which really kind of surprised me that they were common themes, and then say a few words about each paper individually. I wrote up these comments yesterday, but what's really striking to me is that my four common themes also apply to everything else that's been said at this conference. And so I think we are getting some sense of cohesion here that we didn't necessarily expect in advance. So the first theme that I want to talk about is that both papers talk about neither country having a firm conceptualization of what grand strategy means for itself. And I think that emphasizes that we remain in a time of change and flux in thinking about international security and national identity, and it applies to both of these countries, but I think it's something that also came across in our earlier papers this morning. And then given that these are two relatively powerful and important states in the system, they're not just emerging powers, they are powers already, this means that there may not yet be an emerging world order, and I put order in quotation marks, if order means something that is fixed and predictable. We don't have an order at the moment, and I think these two papers emphasize that. And that's really important for me from the perspective that I was coming at this, because I think in the United States there is such a tendency to believe that the emergence of the BRICS and the G20 has redefined the world order, and that the U.S. and the EU are on the back of what's happening, and that there's this emerging system that is there and is the future. And I think both of these papers, as well as the papers that we had this morning, really make clear that we're not sure that that's the direction that things are going. We don't necessarily have any emerging order yet, if order is something that's fixed. The second common theme between these papers is that rather than talking about states that have clearly defined interests, both papers stress the role of individual leaders and individual personalities. And again, that came across this morning in the papers, especially that talked about Turkey and Israel and Brazil, where it was really the leaders and recent leadership changes that had a huge impact on how these countries think about the international system. But here we see that the same thing is true in Russia and in Germany. And this implies that not only is there change in flux in the world order, but that there's change in flux depending on what happens in domestic politics going forward. I think these papers make clear that neither of these countries is clearly realist in its orientation. Constanze says this directly. Fyodor at one point calls Putin a structural realist. You say that early on in the paper. But as the paper goes on, the real meat of the paper makes clear that there's something else going on, that there's an emotional element, a cultural element. It refers to psychological boundaries and overcoming trauma. And that relates very specifically to what Phil Zelikow said in the opening comments in today's conference, where he talked about reacting and symbolism and grievance without solutions. And we didn't talk about this so much in the paper on Turkey, but obviously Ayşe Zarakol says the same thing about Turkey and talks about the relationship between Turkey and Russia in this regard. So I think that's another theme that comes out. Mm-hmm. So if realism is not the framework that's used by other states, This sends an interesting message to those in the United States who still have this very realist idea about what declining U.S. relative power means, as if it has clear implications for the rest of the realist world order, if in fact we're not facing a realist world real order. And I think it also has meaning for the whole question of what grand strategy actually means, which is something else that we've been talking about that Mel has mentioned and that Bill has mentioned throughout. Third common theme. Both papers mention that there may be a disconnect between the way policy elites think about problems and the way that even very sophisticated, ordinary people, like business people, think about problems. In Fyodor's paper, he mentioned a disconnect between the small group of elites at the top and the interests of the middle class. And in Constanza's paper, she talked about there being a political class and then others who were not in the political class. So both papers look at the notion of leadership strategy with a very jaundiced eye. And this, again, gets to the question of, is grand strategy something that still has meaning when we're no longer in a system where it is a small group of elites at the top that are determining the direction that foreign policy necessarily goes in the future? You know, in the Cold War, there was this very agreed set of threats, and that meant that because there was a clear set of threats, there wasn't a lot of distinction going from the top to the bottom of how people thought about the world order. But if now we're in a world order where the politicians are not necessarily in touch with the rest of the reality of the populations that they're working with, what does grand strategy exactly mean? There's no clear threat. There's no clear set of common benefits because of the various interests that are coming to the forefront. And maybe that means that grand strategy is no longer what it used to be. Fourth, both papers have a very uncomfortable mix of very current events, namely what has happened in Crimea and Ukraine, and longer-term trends. And I think this is something that comes across in some of the other papers as well. But certainly both papers are trying to come to terms with Crimea, and that means that when we're thinking about the overall theme for this volume and the theme of the conference, what do we mean by current? By the time the volume comes out, Crimea is going to be history in one way or another, because we know there's going to be at least a two-year lag between this conference and when the actual volume emerges from Harvard University Press, if that comes out. 2 years from now, we're probably not going
to
be talking...
Just to be clear, their papers are due by August.
Okay, right? Okay. But two
sooner,
years...
Sooner!
2 years from now, we're probably not going to be talking about Crimea.
We're trying to figure out how much time it gives Russia.
To we'll be on So that's what...
Can you speed things up?
that's what the common themes are. Now, let me say just a few things about each of the papers individually. On Constanza's paper, it's very detailed in terms of processes and policies, and I think that's its greatest strength. It has an incredible understanding of how policy is actually made in Germany and what all the factors are that go into consideration. And I learned so much from reading this paper. I think it's wonderful. However, I found it organizationally a bit hard to follow because it's so rich. It's got so much content, but it felt like almost an encyclopedia article about everything that you could say about German foreign policy, and I didn't come across with a clear theme, and especially when Constanza talked about writing a book, I can see the book in there, but somehow we have to get it into paper form. The one thing that I thought was very interesting was your discussion of the role of the court, and then when you talked about being a lawyer, I think you've got something here that may be unique to Germany and that really talks about the German identity, and that might be something that you would make the theme about, that you could make that more a theme of how Germany thinks about grand strategy because of those legal questions. I also thought it could tease out more the difference between the institutions of government and the role they play and the role of the individuals who are in those positions. And we sort of talked about this a little bit, but I'm not clear whether your frustration with lack of strategic direction in Germany is due to underlying factors that have to do with how the structure of the system works and how the politics works, or whether it's Merkel's personality and incrementalism in particular, and what one would expect after Merkel's no longer in office. And then similarly, on page 12, you talked about the Bundestag's role declining, but you didn't talk about why. Is that structural, or is it because of particular personalities, particular parties? Would we expect that decline and the rejiggering of power balances domestically to continue? So that's on Constanza's paper. On Fyodor's paper, first of all, I really want to congratulate you because this is a very honest, very brave paper, and that gives me more hope for Russia than anything I've seen in the last 2 months. And the fact that somebody who is in a position as powerful as you are can afford to be so honest and so brave in what you're saying means that I think that there's a lot of hope for the future of Russia. So I just wanted to say that. I thought that the point that you made in your discussion was really interesting. This didn't come out in the paper, but where you talked about how Russians don't see themselves as revisionists because they don't believe a stable world order ever emerged after the end of the Cold War, and the whole thing is still transitory with changing constellation of powers. I don't know if you realize this, but you have just completely replayed the difference between how the United States and the Soviet Union approached the question of realism during the Cold War, because the United States was always focused on the balance of forces, something that's very static, and the Soviet Union was always focused on the correlation of forces, something that was constantly moving. And that was a major theme that came across in my graduate school education. Mm-hmm. And it's just fascinating to me that so much has changed, and we're still in a situation where the United States thinks about things as a new world order, and Russia thinks about things as a correlation of forces that are constantly in flux. So there's something cultural there that I think is really interesting, and I would urge you to try to integrate that into your written paper as well. Just a few comments on the written paper as it stands. One thing I'd like you to deal with more is the question of whether great Russian cultural nationalism of Putin is a new trend that's going to set the grand strategy for the future, or whether it's a blip on the screen that will disappear when Putin disappears, because eventually he'll no longer be in office. And when that happens, will he have set Russia on this new ethnic great Russian national identity as a separate civilization, or is that something that elites are going to turn away from once Putin is no longer in control? The next thing I'd like to see you do more of is to explain the absence of a coherent strategy coming out of Russia. Is it the world that's in flux? Is it that events are changing so quickly that there is no possibility of having a coherent strategy? Or instead, is it because of something that happens in domestic politics? And I can think of at least two separate explanations that come across from a domestic politics standpoint. One is that it's all about domestic power balances in the very small number of people who are in the Russian elite, with various informal networks butting up against each other to determine policy direction. And that's my own perspective, but that doesn't come across at all in your paper. So I don't know, maybe you don't think that that's correct, but it would be interesting to see what you think about this question. I think an awful lot of American scholars and some Russian scholars that I know of think of Russian politics right now as being all about informal networks that are very hard to parse from the outside and very hard to figure out who's actually in control. And do you see that as being responsible for the shifts that are happening in policy? But there's a second possibility about what explains those shifts in policy, and that it's just Putin personally, and that the way that I like to think of it is that Putin is not a chess player. Americans like to have this this stereotype of Russians, that Russians all play chess, and they're thinking several moves down the line. But Putin's not a chess player. Putin is a judo master. And that means, as somebody who's a judo master, you think tactically. You look at your next opponent, and you look for weaknesses in that opponent, and once you make the opponent fall, boom, it's done. You're not thinking about that opponent anymore. You're on to the next event. And that means that as a judo player, he may be thinking about things tactically rather than strategically, and it might say something about himself as an individual and his worldview and how he approaches things. So that's sort of the second comment. How do you explain the absence of a coherent strategy, and what role do domestic politics play in that? That leads to the third comment, which is that I would have liked to see more about processes and how the process works in the Russian system. That was a real strength of Constanze's paper, but I didn't see any of it here. Who sets the policy direction in Russia, and how do they do it? You talk about what's missing in Russia. What is missing, you say, is a means for conveying and coordinating various public interests, but you don't talk about what's there instead. And I know that that might be tricky to do in the current environment, but I think the paper would be stronger if you let us know how policy is currently being made in Russia, and who it is that would be responsible for coming up with a grand strategy, and how the players relate to each other. And then finally, one thing that I saw missing in the paper was anything on military and defense strategy. I didn't see any thinking about the military reforms that Putin has been carrying out, didn't see anything about arms sales, and both of those are core parts of what one normally would think about as being part of grand strategy and certainly very important to the Putin era. So I'll stop there, but two really outstanding papers that have an amazing amount of similarity, even though the countries that they describe are so different from each other.
Kim, thank you. That was a really helpful set of comments, and Mel has been taking furious notes, so I know we're going to use them in inviting our paper writers to reformulate some of their papers and to amend and to expand. I think I'd like to get the rest of the room involved at this point, rather than asking the two paper writers for comments, just because I think there's so much on the table already. Why don't we just jump in and perhaps direct a few questions towards Constanze to begin with about Germany, and we'll take a few, put them on the table, and then we'll do the same with Fyodor, and then we'll let the conversation unfold. Are there any questions particularly that you'd like to raise about the Germany paper? Yeah, Jim.
So actually, it connects the two, because what I found particularly fascinating, maybe it's because it's my preoccupation right now, which is the asymmetry between what has been, at least, the German strategy of using economic interdependence as a tool to constrain, engage, and shape the environment, and Fyodor's point about, given the Russian priorities, that can't work, right? If economics isn't the priority, then all of the kind of underlying theory behind what Germany has been doing vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Russia, between a lot of what it's doing. But I wonder if that, you know, whether you think this has now begun to be seen on both sides, which is, particularly for Germany, you know, was this in fact kind of the core part of the strategy before, that using the economic power, soft power, was a way, in contrast to the United States, to kind of shape the external environment? And does this require rethinking? And Fyodor, is there, I mean, you said that the economics doesn't matter. Is that universally felt, or are there different elements in the political class who may have a different view? One gets the sense that may be Putin's view, but not necessarily everybody in kind of the elites and the influentials in Russia.
I'll throw one question out for Constanze, which is just meant to provoke a conversation. It's not really content rich, but you know, I almost feel that you have talked yourself out of including Germany in the book. and that is to say that your emphasis is that Germany.
That's because she's writing her own book.
That's right. Well, let me tell you what I mean. In the sense that, you know, you've said Germany really doesn't have a grand strategy, it doesn't have a grand strategic tradition. We're probably glad, those of us who study 20th century Europe, when Germans start talking about grand strategy, it's bad news for everybody else. But no, you make the point that since 1945, Germany has had a kind of a strategy, but it certainly hasn't been grand, and it's been fixed for it by external factors, Cold War and so forth, and has sought to, and has now become a very conservative status quo power, and is essentially, in your paper, you're depicted as a country that is trying to grapple with a changing world and is only gradually beginning to rediscover the ability, the need for some kind of strategic thinking, that it essentially has been atrophied in this respect over a long period of time because so much of its freedom of independence was constrained for such a long period of time. And that just makes me wonder, if that's true, why should we have Germany in the book? What does it teach? I guess, what is it telling us, to put it in a more positive sense? What is the German case telling us about the making of strategy that we can't learn from some of these other states?
So, well, can I ask, because I think this is important to the broader enterprise here. I mean, why would you not characterize the Adenauer Kohl approach as grand strategy? Well, I think that's as grand strategy as it gets. I mean, it's in the context of its history. I think that there's a question now whether that's sustainable.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's never in modern times, there's never been a clearer sense of explicitly articulating a strategy, developing all your tools around it. You know,
well, I mean,
consistent across political parties, right?
You can, but I mean, the point is
yeah,
that
you're reflecting what she said.
I'm essentially reflecting back on you, your sense that Germany's options were constrained and have been really
successful. But you can have a strategy even though you are constrained, right?
Yeah. Highly constrained.
You can be highly
constrained. Of course, they manage the cards they have.
Really clear strategy.
Sorry.
I'm tempted to say that this is how it always is.
Despite trying to be the center of attention, Germany is the center of attention.
So there's something I was tempted to say at the beginning of my remarks that said, you know, let's not be prickly right at the beginning, was that few countries, I mean, if you are a German, and if particularly you're sort of an ench person like me, to use a Tony Judd phrase, who's sort of grown up mostly outside of Germany and therefore is an insider outsider, it's both sort of endearing and irritating how much everybody else sort of thinks, you know, they know this place, and you know, and they, and I really, you know, I really don't have to say anything because they already know everything. The thing is, I didn't say, nor did I write, that the period of 45 to 89 was devoid of strategy. Absolutely not. No, I mean, no, and that would be a misreading of what I was writing here. But it's a case of, if you will, you could say that German clarity was aided and supported by the fact that it was hyper-determined by external constraints. And I think it's important to acknowledge those external constraints, because the grand strategy was not something that we sort of cooked up, you know, in a magic cauldron. Yeah? No,
of course not.
Yeah? It was partly imposed, and you have to admit that. And and that has created this...
But is it not true that all nations define a foreign policy or a strategy by recognizing certain constraints and threats?
But what was the issue?
Yeah, but not all of them are occupying while that's happening.
To a civil
extent. Sorry, I didn't hear it.
I'm sorry, but not all of those countries are actually under military occupation while that's happening. So that actually is a slightly different framing than of
constraint. Part of the strategy was to escape military occupation, right? These were pretty clever graphics, right?
Yeah, and one of the reasons why the Germans became such master tactical operators was that a great deal of their not inconsiderable intellectual and political abilities was deployed towards the end of exploiting sort of very marginal opportunities, and very narrow operating margins to maximize German interests, while always, of course, navigating under a flag of NATO first, EU first, you know, everybody else first.
Right.
I'm actually not sure that I think those are mine. The LAZ Treaty was a brilliant maneuver, right, that both dealt with the frictions within NATO and found a way for Germany to hitch itself to France in terms of the European construction and still stay tied to the United States.
Yeah.
Ostpolitik, I mean, that was, you know, I mean, you talk about it sort of masterful within the constraints.
Yeah, I'm not critiquing that per se as in some way hypocritical or sort of as an act of denial. I think the denial and the hypocrisy comes in after 89. Yeah? But what you also have to see, I think, and that maybe I think many Americans don't see, is that the German public became very accustomed to, or bought into some of these narratives wholesale. Yeah, that in other words, that we didn't have agency, that we were, you know, now a moral superpower, and that the entire world was normative, and that in fact we were, through redemption, yeah, and working through of our historical guilt, had arrived at a state of sort of enlightenment that the rest of the world was only, you know, still working towards. That's been something of liability.
I think it's fantastic. And one of the things, rather than kicking her out, I want to push you guys to put Japan in, because I think
because
you have a very similar set of dynamics and raised into a very different environment now. But if you think of all the things you just said were exactly the challenges that Japan faced in terms of a strategy, and we thought that, you know, Japan too had developed this passivity, this no agency for the Japanese public. And now the question is that reality?
It's kind of interesting too. I mean, we've been thinking along the same lines even before the conference. So take the suggestion seriously.
Well,
the funny thing is, you know, if you look at Germany and Japan, they are developing powers that are much further along the chain, along certain tendencies that they share with this group of emerging powers as well, right, in terms of economic development focus, free riding, right? I mean...
Yeah. But I think there's a huge difference between Germany and Japan. I really do. Yeah, both in terms of the sustainability. We are simply, somewhat bizarrely, we're suddenly the power that matters in Europe. Japan isn't in that position in Asia. That's China. Our economic power is at risk, and I've detailed that in my paper, but not quite in the way that Japan is at risk. I mean, there are similarities, obviously, aging societies, pensions, and so on, yada, yada. But the fact of our economic and political integration in Europe gives us a degree of sustainability and leverage that Japan has never had. Also, I mean, you know, there is the question of, you know, how do you deal with the Aristarchal legacy at the risk of being rude to the Japanese? Jesus, they've done a crap job.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was in Japan for the first time last year and went to the museum that's attached to the Yasukuni Shrine, which is truly shocking.
It is absolutely
It is appalling.
Shocking.
I went out after half an hour, you know, because I needed fresh air. I was, you know, thinking, what would this look like if this were all about Germany? And I nearly... Mm-hmm. So I mean, I beg to differ.
My point is that I'm not saying they're the same concept. What I said was that they both faced a similar dynamic, but they faced it in what became a different context. I mean, and from my perspective, which I will talk about tomorrow, it raises also the question about the relationship with the United States, because both of them now have to think about, you know, how they position themselves vis-a-vis the United States in a very different way.
But let me say something else. The other thing that I really don't want to leave you with is this notion that somehow we're not acting strategic. I mean, the Germans are acting hugely strategically in the context of the European crisis. Mm-hmm. The thing is that it is sucked up 98% of their power resources, their ability to strategize, and the leverage that they have. And Ukraine is now providing a massive counterpoint to that, and reframing and in fact sucking resources away from that, and that's what the French are so terrified about right now.
Right.
I've just been in France, and it's, you know, all they worry about, and with good reason. So I mean, one element that I think is still somewhat missing in this in this discussion, and that I think is important for the overall framing of the book, is that so many of us, and including the United States, I would say, are struggling with what in German I would call Überforderung, and I guess you would translate as with being overwhelmed, by the weight, the magnitude, the complexity, and the sheer quantity of strategic challenges that we are faced with. But to say that we are struggling, as I try to honestly say in my paper, is not to say that we're not engaging strategically.
Right. No, I think you've made some very helpful points that I think clarified what my deliberately provocative comments. There's a couple. We have three. This is Chrissy, Yaprak, and then Ellie, and then we want to turn to Fyodor as well. Yeah.
Sure. I think for me, swirling around this a little bit, but as we talk about Germany's expanded sense of agency in relation to thinking about what we've identified as potential passivity in relation to the structure of constraints, has that agency translated into any strategic thinking, different strategic thinking about how to change the structure of constraints?
Okay. Do we want to collect?
Yeah, let's collect a few. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I noticed that in the paper, unlike the other papers, you didn't talk so much about public opinion, and the leaders actually, you know, designing foreign policy or strategy for domestic consumption. Yes. And I thought that it was very interesting. And Germany is the best democracy in this set of papers after India, perhaps. I mean, the most stable democracy, let's say. So I thought that it was interesting that this was absent. Is it really the case that domestic politics or domestic audience, public opinion, doesn't play in as a factor?
Okay. Ellie?
Well, first of all, I just tell you, I take issue with the definition of German democracy, but that we can debate this. The question, there is a normative judgment there in terms of what you actually want a democracy to look like. But leaving that issue aside, I actually had a methodological question. What I'm struck by is the level of analysis challenge. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that people looking at across all of the cases from the inside walk away convinced that there is no strategy. I'm doing things abstractly. Yeah. There is no strategy that you're actually managing to. You're overwhelmed by challenges and so on. It's not that you're not thinking strategically, but the end result is a much more. If we go to the description this morning by Phil, you're talking about the past and haunted by the past, but also platitudes and so on, and you're responding in an ad hoc fashion. The people who are looking at the same country from the outside saying, you miss something fundamental. There is some coherence to what we are seeing about your strategy, right? The Arabs looking at Israel, you know, the Turks or we or whatever, and so on, looking at Germany and say, guys, look, the determination not to use force again is a core feature of German strategic thinking. The reliance on economics is a core feature, and I could go on in every one of those cases. So I wonder where we don't have here some kind of interesting in terms of a phenomenon
if we had to write two papers on the same country, one by an outsider, one by an insider, one would say, guys, you're missing out something. There is enormous coherence there. And someone looking at the chaos and how it emerges and says, there isn't one.
It's actually very helpful because what our original plan was is to have you each reading each other's papers in a direct way so that you could capture precisely that
And I think that the truth may be closer to one pole or the other, but I do think that by looking at exclusively at how complicated the processes of producing, and that's why I think the emphasis on processes and how complicated these processes are and how volatile the environment is, suggests that we may overplaying the level of the conclusion. We may be biasing the conclusion that there is less in terms of cohesion to the strategic outlook than there really is.
Can I just take you on the static idea of Germany and use of force abroad? Because, I mean, you probably know this much better than I do, but I think there's a very active debate inside the German security community about what the role of the German military should be going forward. And that same debate is happening in Japan.
If by the time the debate will be over, there will be no German military left.
I think that's an exaggeration.
I think that if you will look at what happened to the German military in the past 20 years, and what has been left of the German military, there is hardly German military left.
How about maybe I address some of those?
Take a couple minutes, and then we want to give it
once again, we have an outsider looking in.
I want to turn to Fyodor as well,
maybe. But seriously, the problem is one that's larger than that of Germany. The reality is, and this is something I do say in my paper, technology costs are driving all European forces, even including the big three, out of business. And it's not societal preferences. It's the cost of technology and the fact that there is now no piece of kit that doesn't have incredibly expensive and complicated electronics attached to it. I think that is the single biggest alliance wedge that we've ever seen. It's also a huge driver, I think, towards consolidation of the European armaments industry and towards possibly a Europeanization of European defense. Because otherwise, we will be out of business. But it'll not just be the Germans, it'll be all of us.
But just to draw you out of this one, do you argue that much of the cuts in the German military have been the result of the cost of technology or distinguished from preferences of Germany?
No. As I think you probably know much better than I do, military costs are usually the results of preferences that have very little to do with military effectiveness.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, or with a conceptualization of a design that is matched to strategic and military operational needs. Yeah. In reality, there is always, almost always, and even the American process knows this, I think, to some extent, a fundamental disconnect between these things. What I am saying is that in Europe, the situation is now so dramatic, and in my view, has been this dramatic for nearly a decade, that we are all in a situation of where the emperor is pretty much naked. And where if we want to have a functioning defense, we're going to have to really radically reconceptualize it. And I think America and Israel have a considerable interest in us getting that right. Mm. That's for another conference. And I can talk about that until you're blue in the face. On Germans and the use of force. I've sent this to some of you. This is a project that I was involved in, and that gives me some agency, because this is with money from policy planning, the German Foreign Ministry, the main government-funded think tank, and GMF. Getting together to bring together a 1.5-year-long project on German strategy. This has had a bit of an impact, unlike what I thought. The Poles want to do this over. The Danes are thinking of doing it over. The French are really interested in it. I've presented this at the NIC, at State DOD, and in Ottawa, and so on. And this has become something of a framing for what Germans are thinking and how. And if anybody's interested, I can tell you that what you're really interested in and what the answer is to Kimberly's question is the box on page 41. We decided for this to not be a consensus paper, but for us to make dissent explicit. And the most explicit dissent in this paper, apart from the one in the Europe chapter on how much integration we should have, is whether it is permissible to use force without a Security Council authorizing resolution. Mm-hmm. A large enough chunk of us said, absolutely, excuse me, And, you know, in a situation, forgive me for putting it that way, but there was a big fight over this. And we, in the end, said, you know, okay, then let's just put it that way. And there is no intellectually credible middle ground on this. It is either or. Because this is one of the rare cases of a real dichotomy. And that tells you something about how German thinking has evolved. Now, are we going to always fudge it if we come to the fact? You know, are we going to call it, like you did 20 years ago, acts of a genocidal nature, if we possibly can, to avoid having to get engaged? Yes, we will. Yeah. But this does tell you that there is movement there. And you know, we've been engaged in a combat mission in Afghanistan for the last 2 years. We have really robust anti-piracy missions.
What did you call what you did in German in Afghanistan?
It's called a combat mission.
You call it a combat mission. NATO doesn't call it a combat mission when they're not politically correct.
We have a whole other paper and another participant we have
okay,
to
this is
when they pile up all the restrictions,
we're going to have dinner,
what the Germans can
conversation
do in Afghanistan. They don't call it a combat mission.
Okay, the
and
with
the one case you was accidentally killed people, you panicked.
I'm sorry.
Let's bring it.
Actually, not true. We've been hacking away at the caveats and the restrictions. The Germans have
okay. Grand strategy. We can't get sidetracked into too many different things. But we will. It is important, and I don't mean to suggest it isn't important. But Fyodor has been waiting patiently. Jeff, you want to carry us into the?
Yeah, just one question for Fyodor, although it could be asked Costanza too. I'm just interested. What is it? It's. In both the papers, there's a danger of getting wrapped up in Crimea and, you know, the here and now. But one useful way that you might think about Crimea is, what is the lesson of Crimea in the Kremlin? What does that say? And I guess I'm interested in that lesson being, you know, there's obviously a certain track that you thought was going on in foreign policy beforehand, and somehow this has changed everything. So. You know, what was the kind of main discourse before? What is the main discourse now? And how did the Crimea change that? And why should we expect that to endure, right? And kind of asking that question, it's asking what are the sources of foreign policy? But so that's the broad questions. What is the meaning? How is the Crimea understood in the Kremlin? And why does it change policy in an enduring way?
I have two questions for you. You start off by saying that recent crisis or 2013-2014 changed everything. But at other times in your paper, you have argued that starting in 2003 or Putin's consolidation of power already began to change what had been the Yeltsin policies. So you say that there's continuity in the sense of Russia wanted to reestablish its power after the end of the Cold War, but you portray two very different strategies about how to go about doing that, both of which existed long before 2013 or 2014. One was to try to integrate into the West, and then, assumedly, a reaction to that when Russia was rebuffed. And that perception of being rebuffed seemed to inhere a decade ago. And yet you say things started anew only in, you know, very, very recent times. So I'd like you to comment about where is the change, where is the continuity, and how that bears upon overall strategy. And then I'd like to ask you also about the point that Kim mentioned about, at one point in your paper, you emphasize Putin as a realist. But then the whole latter part of your paper is really about Putin as an ideologue, a conservative ideologue. So is he one or is he the other? And how should we be thinking about that? And then I guess the last thing that I'm not clear about is you emphasize Putin's priority as reassembling the old Russian core. And yet at the end of the paper, you emphasize Russia's policy is now oriented or going to be focused on Asia and the Pacific. So strategically, which of those is the priority?
And how should we think about that? It seems confused as I read your paper. So those are my three questions.
Fyodor, why don't you go ahead and get in the conversation? Yeah, that's a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, I start with this realist issue, which was mentioned, and I think it's very, very right point. And this is a clear contradiction in my piece, which I should clarify later in the next stages. The problem is that Putin is the same. So Putin with us since 15 years now. But he's changing. He's very much different today compared to Putin we saw, say, 10 or 12 years ago. And when I wrote about his realist approach, I actually meant Putin number one and especially Putin number two. Putin number three, which came 2012 and started to actively change the pattern to the last year, is different. And this is a big shift, which I mean. It seems, at least now, it might change again because we live in serious flux. But for now, it seems that Putin's realism has been distorted very much by Putin's change toward much more ideologized approach. And that started exactly last year. The conservative trend started. For the first time, he mentioned about that it was December 2012 in his Federal Assembly address for Federal Assembly. And then the whole 2013 was a growing, increasing emphasis on conservative values. His famous Valdai speech was entirely about that. And now the recent speech after when he announced takeover of Crimea, that was another aspect, another element. He added to conservatism, he also added this, I would say it's a national romanticism. It's something much more archaic, actually, coming back to Russian rhetorics, not of Nikolai the First, but maybe Alexander the Third. So it's very much changing. So that's why I will try to clarify everything in the final draft of my paper, but I'm not sure I will be able to do it because it's really much very much a work in progress. And about two strategies also, what Mel was asking. I think by saying that the strategy was basically the same, I mean that the goal was perceived as becoming part of the decision-making club. Perception of means and perception of format of this membership in this club was very much different. And Yeltsin, for example, believed that if Russia will join Council of Europe, G7, all organizations where normal countries are members, then it would mean that we are at least at the table. Maybe not deciding so much, but at least at the table. When Putin came, he started to feel it with more substance. Because his first phase of his rule was very rational, was about to repay all debts, because he understood very well that the country which is heavily indebted and should is dependent on creditors. So he did it very quickly, and that gradually he changed because capacity changed, and his first stage was about to make Russia equal part of this club, offering different deals. For example, when Schröder was chancellor and Chirac was president, he really, and Berlusconi and others, he really wanted to strike a deal with Europeans, so to say, strategic alliance, our resources in exchange for your technologies or something like that. Then he was rebuffed, you're right. And of course, what happened between him and the George Bush administration, that defined a lot of what happens today, because Putin believes that Americans are those with whom you never can deal. They never stick to commitments. And this is George Bush legacy, unfortunately. And of course, Munich speech, which is seen by many in 2007 as a turning point, in fact, it wasn't, because in his Munich speech, the style, the tone was very aggressive, but the substance was exactly the same as Putin's speech in German Bundestag in 2001, for example, which was at that time perceived as something groundbreaking, new relationship, membership in NATO, and so on. So 2007 was a speech by very much disappointed person. I wanted, I offered, and rebuffed. His real turn started when he came back to power. And if you look at his programmatic article prior to the election, it's a completely different perception of the West. His criticism towards the West was not about non-respect to Russia or aggressiveness or so. The criticism was, are you crazy? What are you doing? You destroy everything. The situation is terrible anyway in the world, chaotic, unpredictable, and everything you guys doing is worsening situation. Interventions, your projects, your European currency, which is now a headache for the whole of the world. That was completely different style, completely different way to confront the West. Not disappointment because we didn't become part of, but something much more estranged. And I think that was beginning of his change, and now we see results. Then about economy. Maybe I generalize too much. Of course, economy matters, but the difference is that I don't know. Maybe we in Russia and Putin's generation and my generation as well. We fed up with Marxism when we studied and when we lived in the Soviet Union. So now we are trying to put everything in a different sequence. So Marx rightly pointed out that economy is a basis and politics is something built up on it. So now Russia, it seems that Russia assumes that political development and political might, political strength is more important in today's world. So that generates, political strength generates economic gains and not vice versa. It might be seen as a self-defeating to convince ourselves because economically Russia is much weaker than Europe, U.S. and China. But at the same time, it's his conservatism, his traditionalism. He looks back to traditional ways to assess power, and in this regard. Talking about strategies, that I absolutely agree with you that many countries are seen much more, much stronger and much coherent looking from the outside than looking from the inside. It's no exception for that. Even if you talk to Americans, so you hear the same. In Russia, we believe that America is almighty and everything is pre-calculated since Truman and Eisenhower. But in fact, it's not. So same with Russia, of course. Looking from the outside, from the inside, we see how weak and senseless a lot of the moves are. But what is more or less consistent is a perception of legitimate sphere of interests, and this is not changing. It wasn't different even under Yeltsin. that the post-Soviet area and Eurasia is seen as something which we should be leading force in. It's not changing. Means are changing and formats are changing, but not the very idea. And second thing, of course, perception of what instruments are most important for us. And in this regard, Russia is not at all a soft power country. It's not an economic power country. It's a hard power country. There's a long-term tradition rooted in history, rooted in very classical, vulgar understanding of geopolitics, of continental power, which should be ready to defend itself from all directions. And it's not changing either. So we soft power is extremely fashionable notion today, but I don't see serious changes. Then about Crimea. I think Crimea is very confusing because really we see a lot of new rhetorics. I would say the atmosphere is not very, very inspiring and promising, especially because the picture becomes much more black and white, and it's just the beginning, I'm afraid. But the question, what Kremlin learned for foreign policy, I don't think a lot of Crimea. I don't believe in grand design in this case. My feeling is that Crimea came as an absolutely unexpected trophy when Ukrainian statehood and Ukrainian political model started to collapse unexpectedly. No one could envisage that in December or even early January, and when it suddenly became possible for Putin, putting myself in his shoes, fortunately not, but if I try to imagine, it was a very, very difficult, tough choice, because if he would not use this opportunity, and I don't, I think you know that in Russia, overwhelming majority of people after collapse of the Soviet Union deeply believed that Crimea belonging to Ukraine was unfair, and that was historic accident. It wasn't legitimate part of Ukraine never before. And of course, if Putin wouldn't take this chance, he risked to go to history as a guy who didn't take this chance. And that's why I think it was very difficult to resist. The consequences of this decision, so far at least, I see not in foreign policy, I see mostly in domestic policy, because we have now it was very popular move, and we see real consolidation of society based on this feeling of the pride that Russian geopolitical retreat is over and now we are back. But now further, there is a complete confusion what to do with this, what to do with this consolidation, because coming back to the economy issue, Crimea as such is a very expensive toy. It will cost a lot. It will generate a lot of criticism very soon by other parts of Russia, because now all money will go there, and people in, say, Tatarstan or, I don't know, Ulyanovsk will ask why them, why not us? And so this is a very much moment of truth for the government, what to do with this national consolidation. As for foreign policy, I wouldn't wish that, but I would understand if Putin would not stop in Crimea and would continue towards eastern, southern Ukraine, maybe Kiev. Strategically, it would make more sense. I disregard now the moral and so on. But strategically, it would make more sense than to just to take Crimea. Now it seems that there is a certain degree of confusion what to do next, because foreign policy implications are huge. A trophy is very good, but short-term. And shift to Asia, which you ask, yes, it should be a priority, and everybody's talking about that. But shift to Asia will occur in the much worse circumstances now, because China is very much happy to see how Russian-American relations are collapsing. And they, of course, they will put completely different conditions on this rapprochement with Russia than, say, 2 months ago.
Well, we're at the, you know, the end of the session, but I think, are there any follow-up questions or thoughts that you want to throw? Yeah, Constanza, please. Just so long as it's not about the combat brigade.
I would love to go on discussing all this with Fyodor, because this raises so many issues. But I want to, and obviously I'd also like to have the opportunity, which I suppose I will do in the redrafting, to respond to all of Kimberly's points, which were very well taken and very useful. But I will say one thing to Professor Legro, and that is, what has happened in Crimea and what is may still happen with Ukraine, in Moldova, and in Georgia is not in any way current as opposed as in the meaning of unstrategic or irrelevant. Mm-hmm. I believe that this is
a transformative moment.
A transformative moment, absolutely. It is a holy shit moment for Europeans. And I was sitting there thinking, my God, this reminds me of the Yugoslav wars. Yeah, this is. I know that feeling in my stomach. I know it when I see it, and I know that I'm going to be thinking about this and working on this for the next decade. Yeah, and I'm very serious. When I would have torn up my paper if I had written it before February 21st and rewritten it. And what I have now is the best possible attempt at reframing it under the obtaining conditions. But I think that this will continue to, and this introduces huge new tensions in European and German strategy in ways that are yet uncharted. I've tried to explore some of the tensions that it creates.
So just to say, what fundamental orientation of Germany or perhaps your own mindset did it undermine, and what orientation did it feed and encourage?
It, I think for the framing of the last 5 years since the onset of the European crisis was that Germany's overwhelming strategic priority, but besides which all other strategic priorities paled, would be saving the European project, and that in this it was a default leader for the foreseeable future because of the introversion or distraction of other powers, and particularly of the UK and of France. Yeah. You may not like the incrementalism, the tactlessness, the galumphingness of the German response, but did we rise to the challenge? I think we did. And nor, as I say in my paper, did we always have it our way. You know, we were forced to make some really significant concessions as to how this was going to be managed. Right? Nor, I think, if you talk to the Greeks and they're being honest about it, would they say that they're being being hammered by Germany and that none of this is in their interest or is actually doing things that are only bad for Greece. Yeah. What you are seeing, though, is a revolution in the European project, and this actually relates to our larger issue here, in that we are, for the first time, seeing a framing of European integration which also looks at the functioning of our political economies on the inside. In other words, at the domestic operating conditions which make us vulnerable or less vulnerable to external strategic shocks. What we were considering for the last 5 years was that these strategic shocks would only be of an economic nature. What we're now being faced with again is a kind of return of history, where that strategic cost shock can also be of a military nature. Now, something I didn't write in my paper, and Fyodor, that I would love to discuss with you, so you will have to come to Berlin, or I will have to come back to Moscow, or we'll have to get these wonderful people to invite us again, and Lufthansa not to be on strike, is that Russia has always been the lurking issue for Germany, even in the European crisis. For the simple reason that if you talk to German experts on Russia, their take on what is going on in Russia, on the fundaments, the assets of Russian power, is very bleak. And most people will tell you that they think that the meta trends in Russia are all going downhill at an alarming rate, and that this is probably the most significant external strategic challenge on the continent to the European project and to Germany's role in it. And we are, in fact, already seeing that materialize in what I think Meshergani has called the dark underside of globalization. Movements from the East, and not always originating from Russia, often enough from Odessa or other places, but also from Russia, not just of the Russian middle class and Russian capital, which has been massive,
but also of cybercrime, organized crime, prostitution, drugs, arms, and so on. All of which, you know, could become a massively destabilizing influence, has already been seen, the destabilization of the eastern periphery from Belarus to the Caucasus, but also has been seen within Europe in the Russian influence, for example, in the last Bulgarian national elections. Yeah. So in other words, what has happened with Ukraine is not just, you know, what the CEO of Siemens recently in national TV called a temporary turbulence, temporary turbulence. Yeah. But rather a coming into shape, yeah, that was already foreshadowed and was hanging over everything else that we were doing, yeah, and is now, I think, reframing the way we think about Europe, our relationship with America, and is certainly reframing our perspective on our neighborhood.
Can I ask another question? Because it's really interesting. Sure. So, and my perception has been that one of the challenges Germany has had is that it's attempted to pursue two reconciliations simultaneously, one with Poland and one with Russia.
Yes.
And the question is now, and for different reasons and some similar reasons, but now, does this now sort of solve that problem for Germany in the sense that it becomes now the possibility of Poland-Germany as a kind of a...
Yeah, that's a really good question. Do you want to add that something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead,
All right. This is because one of the things that I didn't really talk about in the paper, because I sort of ran out of time, was how this is changing bilateral relationships. The Poles have been incredibly successful in gripping us around the waist and marching us in lockstep, you know, into Eastern Europe. I mean, the Germans were hanging back on investing in the Eastern Partnership for the longest time for the very clear reason that we thought the Russians had legitimate interests that we didn't want to challenge and didn't want to upset. Yeah. And not so much because we think the Russians are awesome and we love Vladimir, but because when you sit in Berlin, the prospect of an unraveling of Russia is even more terrifying than a prospect of the unraveling of the Eastern neighborhood. Yeah. So this is why the Germans have a strategic interest here, not so much in making nice with the Russians, but in playing a long game that manages whatever is going to happen, which is probably going to be deeply chaotic and a profound concern to us. Try and manage that as best we can. That's the framing here. That's why, you know, that's the real, and the I think the only major difference of opinion that we have with Washington on this. Now, the Poles are as happy with Germany as they've ever been. I mean, there are intense, close relations between the foreign ministries, the other ministries. The Poles are always in Berlin, and we're always in Warsaw. Yeah. The French are looking on this and saying, wait a moment, you know, we thought this was a Berlin-Paris axis or a triangle, and frankly, we're suddenly feeling left out. You know? Now, obviously, we have a realist interest in that because the Poles are giving us legitimacy and cover in an area where actually our position was somewhat exposed and not, you know, in policy terms, really not cohesive, not well thought out, and, you know, suboptimal in many ways. Something very similar, albeit a somewhat smaller level of qualitative and quantitative impact, is what the Balts have been doing.
Yeah. What
the Baltics, Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians. They have gone through austerity reforms of their own, which have in many ways ended up with them being and sounding more German than the Germans, which is entertaining if you're sitting in Riga listening to them, because you suddenly feel very Mediterranean in so many ways. But but the reality is that there is now a sort of German-Polish-Baltic bloc, which with a really important Swedish component in there. And where the French and the UK and the southern periphery economies of Europe are sitting there saying, wait a moment, okay, we get it, but what does all this mean for European integration, for growth, for stabilization, and for a host of other issues that we thought we had your attention on?
Yeah. But up till now, there's still been the tensions, with the tension in NATO, with the Eastern Security if Germany's strategy vis-a-vis Russia changes, presumably that...
Yes, that is, again, something that is much misread outside, I think. And you know, again, I didn't want to be snide or dismissive when I said, you know, the Americans always seem to think they know Germany. What I will say, though, is that it does help to speak and read German, and that fewer people than you would think do, in much the same way that it helps to speak or read Hebrew or a Russian. And so there's a great deal of projection going on that I think sometimes you just need to sort of
put a finger on. But the NATO issue is slightly different, and it has much less to do with our being congenitally reluctant to involve NATO, because you actually have had the defense minister saying, of course we have to do reassurance. I mean, the Germans have actually been quite out there. And even Steinmeier, for whom this has intellectually, emotionally, in terms of ingrained political preference, has been the longest journey, you know, has moved massively.
I'm thinking about sort of the debate about nuclear weapons in Europe, right?
Yeah.
And so you had, Germany was the most vocal to push for the zero option.
Right? Yeah.
And then you had...
Okay, that's a little different because the nuclear issue is so special. I would suggest that we can discuss that, but I would suggest that that's less relevant here than you might think. What is relevant, I think, is that the Germans are quite willing to do the whole reassurance thing. I think they're worried about NATO involvement in Ukraine. If the Russians move on to Transnistria, or, God forbid, you know, into other parts of Ukraine, that's it. Yeah, I mean, there will be a membership perspective for the EU and for NATO for Ukraine faster than you can think. Yeah. So it depends on Russia at this point.
Colleagues, I just want to ask Fyodor to weigh in. He wants to say a few more things, and I think we'll probably wrap it up, and we can continue over dinner. Remember, we have all evening. Fyodor, you have the last word.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just add one sentence to what Constance was saying. I think you're absolutely right about the profound change of nature of European politics due to many, many reasons. I would add shift in public opinion and rise of ultra-left, ultra-right, and so on. But as for Eastern Europe and the new Eastern Europe, like Ukraine, I think we should being here frank and open. We should understand that some countries which emerged after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they failed so far to become real countries. And the case of Ukraine, in fact, is a tragic case because we can blame Russia, we can blame Europe, we can blame anybody else for mistakes or even crimes committed towards Ukraine. But it was a profoundly mismanaged country from the beginning until now. By all presidents, by all prime ministers, by all oligarchs who played the leading role in politics. And when I see now that the most likely cancellation of new rulers there will be same, actually, set up of oligarchs like Poroshenko, like Kolomoisky and others, that's a disaster. Was revolution about that? And that's the biggest challenge to all of us, to Russia, to Germany, to Poland, to Americans, how to deal with the country which is unsustainable and which cannot produce an elite, an establishment which can rule the country.
I think that what came out from Fyodor's presentation and the discussion thereafter is that if we take the notion that it was not a grand design, but an ad hoc response, that what we're really seeing is strategy being shaped by being sucked in to follow up on a decision you have taken for ad hoc reasons, which then becomes the strategy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the one thing leads to another. Yeah. And by the way, I think that holds true not just for Russia. So what this really is that an ad hoc case which where you cross the line for whatever, you know, it doesn't even economic intervention
in
the EU. Mm. All of a sudden, that fundamentally changes the nature of the strategy.
Well, of course, because improvisation changes threat perception, and with changed threat perception, you develop different priorities, etc.
One is create threat perception. Another one is you created a precedent, which is then makes it more difficult to resist. So there are all kinds of dynamics that are unleashed as a result, both on your end, that you have to defend it. I just saw in the news today there were 25 Ukrainians that have been arrested and so on. So all the kind of implications that now flow from the decision you have taken. You've created a principle to justify it, but then people say, okay, now you've created the principle, aren't you going to apply it on us?
Fyodor, that might be something that you could follow up in your paper a little bit, just to say, you know, if this is, maybe this current crisis is the result of improvisation, but it's created a new environment that now begs for a strategy.
This is what's exactly happening in Turkey as well.
Exactly. I think that happens
exactly
in all.
Exactly what's happening. Yeah. Because, I mean, Erdogan thought, like, you know, I'm going to have good
relations.
But it
doesn't always stick.
Of course. Yep.
So history is one day.
Now, then it takes a lot of energy to try and change it.
Most things are one day.
We should wind up now. We've come to the end of the session, but
it's
we can continue over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know how late it is there for you, Fyodor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you very much for your participation. We will follow up with more comments in a written form for you to work on.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fyodor. Bye-bye. Okay, bye.
I hope the FSB doesn't arrest tonight.